Thank you, Professor Herbers, for the presentation and colleagues who have come here to listen about a place which may not be the center of your own scholarly research, so I hope to make it an interesting place nevertheless. I will start, given our mixed backgrounds of research, I will give some very basic introductory remarks about Armenia and Armenian Christianity in order to place the text that I'm dealing with in a context. The picture is not strictly speaking about crisis, but I thought it would be nice to look at some manuscript paintings and some Armenian priest in Jerusalem praying that the end of the world doesn't come very soon, maybe. Okay, so some basic facts. The traditional Armenia considers itself to have been one of the first countries to have Christianized on the state level. The Christianity penetrated there already in the end of the second, third centuries, but it was adopted as the official religion of the state sometime at the beginning of the fourth century. The date 301 is the traditional date. Some scholars think it may have actually been after the Edict of Milan, so 314, others consider it to have been even at the end of the third century, but it was officially Christianized very early, and the names of two people were quite important for this process. That was the King Tiridat III, known also the Great, and Saint Gregory the Illuminator, who is considered to be the founding father of the Armenian Christianity. It is important to know that when we say Armenia, it's a concept that geographically varies a lot over the centuries. In late antiquity, in 384, Armenia was divided between two spheres of influence: the eastern part under Sasanian Persian rule, but maintained its ruling king, and the western part, which went to the Roman Empire. And this is where the border ran through between the Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Roman Empire, and the Sasanian Iran. In Sasanian Iran, the Arshakid dynasty remained, the kings were maintained, even though they were subjugated to the Sasanians, but the kingdom remained until 428. And this part of Armenia in classical sources is known as Pers Armenia. Whereas the Roman part of Armenia in classical sources appears to Armenia Minor. Sometimes when classical sources talk about Armenia, they are actually referring to Armenia Minor and not necessarily to the greater part of it, which was Pers Armenia. Pers Armenia also can be called Greater Armenia to signify that part of Armenia that did not fall under Roman jurisdiction. And this border, of course, also changed over time with Justinian, with Heraclius, with Arab conquest, etc. An important, again, for the creation of the so-called national ethnic mythology or ideology, the way, whatever you want to call it, was the creation of the Armenian alphabet in 405-406 by a monk, Mestrok Mashtots. His purpose was to create an alphabet in order to translate the Bible into Armenian, in order to preach Christianity in Armenian. Prior to this, we do not have any writings prior to this. The Armenians used cuneiforms, not in Armenian, though. The language they used was Aramaic, which was the language of the administration of the Persian Empire. And there are also Aramaic inscriptions, not cuneiform, but Aramaic inscriptions in Aramaic letters. And of course, from Aramaic comes Syriac, which was a language very well known, especially in the southern parts of Armenia. Another fundamental event was 451, a battle that took place between the forces of Sasanian Iran, an empire, and the Armenians, who had been leading a guerrilla warfare. There was a tendency, perhaps under the influence of Christianity, the Zoroastrian Iran consolidated a so-called Zoroastrian church. It's not an appropriate term, but consolidated, it seems like, in the image of Christianity, presenting Zoroastrianism as the only orthodox religion of a state religion. Since Armenia was part of it, of course, it had to comply to this religious policy as well. And of course, Armenians were Zoroastrians before the adoption of Christianity, so there was also a lot of support for this policy within Armenia. At any rate, the Battle of 451 was presented in the general narrative of Armenian as this small nation that is being attacked by a vast empire and is ready to go to a martyr's death rather than change its faith. So this was the big narrative discourse that remains even today in Armenian historiography. This is just a regional, a contemporary regional map in order to contextualize better. Today's Armenia is 1/10 of the historical Armenia. So let's say this would be the roughly historical extent where the Armenians lived, and the modern Armenia is just that small place. Now, the beginning of political prophecies can be traced in a writing that is accredited to anonymous vision, attributed to a certain saint, Sahak. You will be hearing a lot of saints' names today. The letter was the last Catholicos, which means the head of the Armenian Church, from the line of Saint Gregory the Illuminator. His death almost coincided with the termination of the Arshakuni royal dynasty at 428. So 428, the dynasty was suppressed. 438, Sahak the Great died. The combination of the two events was retrospectively elaborated upon some decades later, in the second half of the 5th century, and explained in eschatological terms in the vision of Saint Sahak, which is actually a vaticinium ex eventu, so a prophecy that looks back, but actually as if prophesizes as if it were future, on the fall of the Armenian kingdom and the end of the Gregorian line of Catholicoi. The vision was inserted in a 6th century, early 6th, the date is considered to be 500, history, known history of the Armenians by Ghazar Parpetsi. This was probably a reaction to Yazgird II's Iranian Shahanshah's policy of imposing Zoroastrianism in Armenia, supported by some Armenian nobles, but vehemently resisted by others. It also polemicizes the vision of Saint Sahak against certain Catholicoi who were placed on the throne of Saint Gregory on the part of the Sasanians. So the line ended, the dynasty, and there was a very strong idea that it should belong. There was a strong dynastic nobility in Armenia. And this referred also to the church. Saint Gregory was married and had children before he, the tradition says, the wife went to the monastery and he came to Armenia to Christianize Armenia. So did his children. So before taking on the offices, they were married and they had children. So the line continued within the same house. An important aspect of the vision, like so many historical apocalyptic texts, was to provide an exhortation and a scheme of future history full of messianic hopes. The vision of Saint Sahak says, since it tells about terrible things that will happen, that the kingdom will end, and but it says, near the time of the appearance of the impurity of the desert, a king from the race of the Arshakuni will rise, and the chair of the chief priests, so Catholicoi, will be renewed by someone from the line of the Holy Gregory. In this vision, including in the quotation above, we find no personified image of a villain, like as such as an antichrist. The author refers to the appearance of impurity from the desert. I have translated it literally, but it can be also normally it's called as abomination of desolation, which was found in the prophecy of Daniel 9:27, but is also cited in Matthew 24:15. He uses also terminology such as enemy of the truth or the prince of perdition, who denote antichrist-like rulers, which probably means Sasanian shahs. But the eschatological drama of the evil ruler versus the virtuous Christians takes a minimum space in the entire writing. What interests the author is its historical dimension with regards to the fate of the Armenians in this world before the end. The significance of this vision for later apocalyptic traditions composed in Armenian is the fact that it poses this motif: the restoration of the Armenian kingdom and priesthood by the only legitimate dynasties that could be thought of, the Arshakunis and the Gregorites. Thus, not only does the vision propose a model of a double messianic renewal, found also in Jewish messianic texts, amongst others, very strong in the Dead Sea Scrolls, this double messianism, but has a strong dynastic allegiance, understandable in the context of late antique Armenia. Despite these very clear dynastic connotations, the vision will be reinterpreted along the lines of other interests in the Middle Ages. I'm going to skip this. I went ahead. But the resistance against Sasanian Iran, this is how the prophecies work. They go back and they go forth. Vaticinia ex evento, but then they go back. The resistance against Sasanian Iran did not mean a clear-cut distinction between the so-called victimized Christian Armenians and their evil Zoroastrian overlords, as the written sources would want us to believe. In fact, the Armenians shared a number of social institutions, such as the hereditary dynastic princes, with their neighbors, the Iranians. Moreover, underneath the Christian layer, many Zoroastrian beliefs persisted in the so-called popular folkloric religion down to the 20th century, not to mention a large portion of religious vocabulary that is tinted with Zoroastrian concepts and is of Parthian origin, including the title Illuminator. Some people would say, yes, it makes a reference to the Greek baptism, which is photismos, illumination, but it has also connotations. For example, the prophet Zoroaster was considered to be an illuminator. So supposedly the contemporaries whose religion was Zoroastrianism, it had a double meaning, and it worked for the original religion. But more significantly for today's lecture, I would like to mention the Mithraic aspects of Zoroastrianism in pre-Christian Armenia. God Mitra, sometimes identified with the sun, responsible for the covenants and order in the world, became a messianic figure in the Armenian tradition. An interesting legend which resurfaces in the sources from the 7th to the 13th century, but was written down also from oral traditions in the 20th century, talks about the enclosure of Mithra in a cave near Lake Van, which is known as the Gate of Meher, or the Gate of Mithra. So according to these legends, Mithra will reemerge when evil has overcome the world in order to bring proper order and justice. A persistent interest in political prophecies and eschatology in the Armenian tradition, as opposed to, for example, personal eschatology, such as journeys to heaven or hell to understand how the world works, this is not so popular as opposed to political eschatology, which must at least have some connection with this Zoroastrian path. And as I mentioned, the prophecy of within the vision of Saint Sahak was thus also a restorative political eschatology, where the past figures out in an idealized form and the future is imagined as going back to a golden age when King Terdat and Saint Gregory were ruling, so bringing back these dynasties. But what about the Christian input into the matrix of Armenian prophecies and Armenian Christianity in general? As noted above, The creation of the Armenian alphabet in 405 or 6 was very much an evangelizing enterprise. It was done in order to preach the Bible in Armenian, since previously the scriptures were read either in Syriac, in the southern districts of Armenia, or in Greek. So I have the map in this southern district of Armenia. The Syriac was much more commonly known, whereas in the northern districts, the Christianity was influenced very much from Cappadocian, Greek Cappadocian type Christianity. Whereas here we had the Syriac current of Christianity. As soon as the alphabet was invented, the first text that was translated was the Bible. It is known as the queen of translators because of its perfect language. And it is clear that there must have been a very strong epic tradition before, or poetic tradition. Otherwise, you cannot just translate the Bible overnight with adequate language and adequate vocabulary. After that, a period of intense translations followed, which included the so-called patristic texts, the founders of the church, translated both from Greek and Syriac. Some of them, such as works of Philo or Ephrem Syros, survive only in their Armenian translations, while the originals have been lost. For my purpose here, I would like to mention the works of such church fathers as Hippolytus, Pseudo-Hippolytus, and Irenaeus, who wrote about the end of the days and who developed the image of this this end of the times villain, the Antichrist. These works were translated into Armenian, and we will see their influence on the texts that I am studying. It seems like the revelation of St. John, the canonical apocalyptic work, was also translated in the 5th century. It seems like it did not become part of the canon. The biblical manuscripts which contain this text date the earliest to the 10th century, and it became a part of the canon, it seems like, only in the 12th century Cilician Armenian milieu. I'll show you the maps where that is, where there was a lot of Western influence on the Armenian church. So I hope this long introduction was not superfluous for positioning my talk. What am I doing here, meaning in Ikagesh, okay? Not right now. What am I studying here? What is my project? The translation movement that started with the creation of the alphabet did not stop in the 5th century. It continued throughout the Middle Ages. The type of texts were expanded from patristics, the Bible and the patristics, including philosophy and sciences, religious polemic, historiography. The languages were also expanded. There were translations from Arabic and as well as Georgian in the 12th century. Apparently, non-canonical eschatological prophecies were part and parcel of this program too. They have received much less attention by the scholars. Understandably, it is more glorious to study John Chrysostom or Ephrem Syros than an anonymous text which doesn't have an author, a name, a date, talks about weird topics, but which I believe can tell us a lot about the contemporaries and about the mindset, not only which has a huge manuscript tradition which talks about the popularity of this text as opposed to Philo, for example, unfortunately, yes? So I have mentioned three texts here I'm mentioning. The first is the names I have kind of selected following an Armenian scholar from the 50s. They have very long titles in the manuscripts. The first is the Agatangel on the End of the World. In the manuscripts, the author appears differently as Agaton, Agadron, and Agatangel. The name Agatangel is clearly fashioned on one of the foundational books of the Armenian Christianity, ascribed to a certain Agatangeros, who wrote the Life of Saint Gregory, which talks about the conversion of Armenia to Christianity. We do not know who this Agatangeros was either, but his name is obviously a pseudonym and deliberately fashioned on Evangelos. The second text you see is the Prophecies of Agaton. Here too, the title is abbreviated from the manuscripts. Sometimes these Also here, the author appears again as Agathon, Agathon. So through centuries, there has been a confusion between the two texts. In fact, my own iter of how I got to Agathangel, which is what I'm focusing now, was when I started studying the text of Agathon, because it was a medieval 12th century text relevant to my research into Armenians and Crusades. But my review of manuscripts showed that we are actually talking about two different texts ascribed to the same author in certain manuscripts. Thus far, I have identified 18 manuscripts of the End of the World of Agathangel, of which I have had access to 14, more or less. I have digital photos. I'm looking forward, or not, to transcribing them on the huge screens that we have in our offices, which are less painful for the eyes when you're reading a manuscript and you have to transcribe it. I realized that Agathon, this medieval prophecies, could not be understood without knowledge of Agathangel. So I stopped my work on Agathon and started working on this earlier prophecy on which I would like to talk about in more detail. But it is important that I mention already, and I will expand on this, is another one, a vision of Saint Nerses. This Saint Nerses was a great grandson of Saint Gregory the Illuminator, a real figure. And he was the grandfather of Sahak, who wrote a vision. The vision of Saint Nerses is included in his life. We do not know from what century it is. The earliest manuscripts is 11th century. The earliest layer of the text may go back to the 7th century Byzantine-Persian wars, and I will expand on that. The importance of the vision of Saint Nerses for my work is that it seems to be the earliest text to cite motifs that come from Agathangel. So it's kind of in between Agathon and Agathangel. So this is how I would put the relative chronology. I'm still working on more absolute chronology. Okay, Agathangel on the End of the World was probably composed in Greek. It is not at all interested in Armenia. There's nothing about Armenia in this text. It's mainly interested in the fate of the Byzantine Empire, and in fact it tells the reign of three Byzantine emperors. It has the myth of the last Roman emperor, which will be extremely important. It will get to the West through the prophecies of Pseudo-Methodius, about which also Michelina de Cesare talked, and would be especially popular, of course, in the German lands, given the Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages. Its focus, I would say, is the fate of the Roman Empire, but especially anti-Jewish polemic, mixed with an apology, which is interesting. And I will expand about on it. It seems to be pre-Islamic. It was probably created, I think, in an Asia Minor environment. I have identified some of the sources, which are Hippolytus and Pseudo-Hippolytus, Pseudo-Methodius, and the Tiburtine Sibyl. It seems to me to maintain an older version of the last Roman emperor myth than Pseudo-Methodius, which was, by the way, Pseudo-Methodius was composed in Syriac in the 7th century under the influence of the Arabic Islamic conquest in the Near East, which tried to explain the Islamic conquest in the scheme of Prophet Daniel and the Four Kingdoms. And it also has the last Roman emperor motif. The components of the political chaos, which was the title of my book, is of course the end of the Roman Empire and the rule of the Antichrist. The last Roman emperor also has this motive of the last Roman emperor traveling to Jerusalem and placing his crown on the Golgotha as a way of ending all earthly political rule before the second coming of Jesus. Agathangel has a very strong interest in the so-called biography of the Antichrist. Here too we find many late antique motifs, but also some which appear in Pseudo-Methodius, such as the tradition of the three woes, which are related to the life of Antichrist, which refer to Matthew 11, 21, 23, Luke 10, 13, 15, where Jesus is saying, "Woe to you, Bethsaida, woe to you, Chorazin, and woe to you, Capernaum." So this is interpreted according to the editor of Pseudo-Methodius. Pseudo-Methodius is the first author to have taken these vows and made them applicable to the Antichrist. However, this motive is much more coherent in the Agathangel, and I think that it probably refers on the same source as Pseudo-Methodius. It also dwells on the reconstruction of the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem. And this is where the anti-Jewish polemic comes into play. Okay. While the main targets of the author's polemic are the Jews, he expresses a certain anxiety also about the Greco-Roman culture, specifically the Hellenic language and the classical philosophy, which he calls external writings, a technical term used by Christian authors to denote acceptable but non-Christian works, such as Plato or Philo, philosophical works normally. We should also note that Antichrist's father in this tale is a Greek merchant and a eunuch at that. His career path includes a brilliant education in Constantinople, a philosophical education. These elements, along with the total absence of any mention of Islam, I understand this is argumentum ex silentio, but in my opinion, it would be inconceivable to write a work after Pseudo-Methodius, after the rise of Islam, and completely overlook it. I'm still playing with the idea if the Jews are real Jews or it's an anti-Islamic polemic. I don't like this line of argument. It's done in scholarship. There's people who are against it. I side rather with people who are against it because in the Armenian tradition, there's no problem to write against Islam. So I don't see why they would choose a fictional community, Jews, and write an anti-Jewish polemic when their real targets are Muslims. So I don't really agree with this a bit convoluted logic. I think simply it probably does not know Islam yet. The anti-Jewish polemic is framed in soteriological and prophetological terms. The main issue at stake is the ability to recognize the true Messiah, the true Savior, and this is possible, according to the author, only upon the correct reading of the scripture, particularly the Old Testament prophets. Thus, it appears, what appears and is accepted as a Messiah by the Jews is actually the Antichrist who imitates Christ. It is the Jews' inability to interpret correctly their own prophets that leads to such a disastrous outcome of events. Of course, this was a very common line in disputation literature going back to Justin Martyr in the second century. The figure of Antichrist is hardly a coherent one. On the one hand, he's considered to be a human being with an earthly genealogy, mother from the tribe of Dan, very canonical for Antichrist texts, and the Greek father from Pontus. On the other hand, he's the son of Satan and has demonic minions who come at his service and help perform false miracles. The latter dimensions of the Antichrist seem to have been a feature of tradition stemming in Asia Minor, away from the watchful eye of Constantinople and the Imperial Church, where the elevation of the human Antichrist to a demonic status would pose obvious theological problems. This is almost a divine element of evil which could not fit into the Christian monotheistic system. Even though the tribe of Dan, as that of the Antichrist, goes back to Irenaeus of Lyon, who apparently used previous Jewish biblical exegesis, Agathangel expands upon this notion, basing himself on an anti-Jewish, eschatological interpretation of the Bible. Thus, according to him, the tribe of Dan is also that of Ahitophel and of Judas Iscariot. These two biblical figures share some common features and negative connotations. Ahithophel was King David's treacherous advisor who instigated the latter's son to rebellion and eventually committed suicide. Similarly, Judas Iscariot betrayed his teacher and ended his life in the same manner, suicide. In an anonymous Midrashic text, Ahithophel, along with Balaam, Gehazi, and Doeg, is named as one of the individuals who will not live to see the world to come, and may have functioned as a type standing for an apostle, possibly embodying Apostle Peter. Moreover, a later Talmud replaces Jesus with Balaam, according to Peter Schaeffer, thus in this text not only associating the Christian Messiah with bad company, but denying him and his followers access to the world to come. By assigning Ahithophel to the tribe of Dan and consequently to that of Antichrist, Agathangel, or the biblical exegesis on which he relied, are probably responding to an anti-Christian Jewish midrash. The inclusion of Judas Iscariot in the same party has an identical purpose, given that Judas Iscariot had a vibrant career in such a text as Sefer Toledot Yeshu, which is an anti-Christian Jewish counter-historical text. However, as I said, the polemic against the Jews is not so one-sided. While it may seem, so they are following, first the Jews follow Antichrist and believe that this is a Messiah. All of this may seem a vicious diatribe nurtured in the worst traditions of Christian anti-Judaism, but Agathangel's story can be read also as a type of an apologetic for the Jews. In fact, the author spells out the Jewish position vis-a-vis the oppression of the Christian powers, presumably the Byzantine Empire. This is done in the form of a dialogue between the Jews and the Antichrist. It's very interesting. It raises very much the drama of the text. The Jews are complaining to the Antichrist, saying, "Please help us from," I quote, "the foreign and pagan nations. Save us from our enemies and deliver us from all the hated ones and put to shame those who oppress us." Nowhere in this mini dialogue and the rest, which I'm not citing, it is implied that the complaints or the lamentations of the Jews were insincere or that they deserved their sorry lot. The dialogue does not leave the impression of being an artificially constructed conversation. Jews are presented as genuinely grieving for their unjust treatment and thus appear to be implicitly justified for believing somebody who claimed to be their savior, which from a Christian position was the Antichrist. Moreover, he also promised to build the Temple of Solomon, so what else do you want? Of course they are going to follow this guy. This is yet another element which I think is important for placing it in this time period between 416, 428, maybe 430s, definitely before the first Arabic incursions. In this time, there was a policy of the conversion of the Jews on the side of Emperor Heraclius. So Persians were first captured Jerusalem, and it seems like they handed over the administration of the city to the Jews, which gave rise to a lot of messianic hopes amongst the Jews and texts. In 628, when Heraclius won the war, he brought back the true cross to Jerusalem with great pomp, placing it on the Golgotha with very clear eschatological and apocalyptic connotations. He started his program of the conversion of the Jews in 632, I believe. But there are texts such as a very famous, really interesting text, Doctrina Jacobi Nuptae Baptizati, which says, is it really right to oppress these people to convert? It really is showing the psychological drama of a community, which is in Carthage actually, which says, well, why can we not celebrate Sabbath? Sure, yes, we believe that Jesus was the Messiah, but we want to celebrate the Sabbath too. What is bad about it? What is bad in celebrating God in more than one way? And then there is an answer from a member of the community. But it is kind of an apology, which I see also carried on in this Agathangel. So why are we oppressing? What, when you are forcing people to convert, you are making fake Christians. This was the position also of some church fathers, such as Maximus the Confessors, who spoke against this conversion. So I believe this kind of polemic, which is more than 50% of the text of Agathangel, fits this context. And if it is correct, then Agathangel can turn out to be a very important link between post-Islamic apocalyptic texts and their extreme diffusion in Eastern, Western Christians, pseudo-Methodians is translated in Greek, Latin, Slavonic. I believe there is an Arabic version, but it's a derivative version, so not interesting for a philological point of view, but from a historical point of view. And some of these motifs, like the last Roman Emperor motif, the career of the Antichrist, the deposition of the crown, and the significance of the cross, which is passed on to Pseudo-Methodius. This is another witness of a pool of traditions on which Pseudo-Methodius was built. I do have time, I hope. Yes, because I have a lot more still. Okay. So what happens when this text comes to... Yes, Agathangel also has, of course, its political interest and the chaos that is created by Antichrist, end of the Roman rule, but it also has signs of natural disaster. Some of them seem to come from Jewish traditions, like mountains which become flat, seem to be very strong in Second Temple apocryphal eschatological texts. Others are normal. You would expect to find them in other texts, like earthquakes, storms, stars falling. And very important is the influence of the fire and the universal conflagration. I would be tempted to think there is some kind of Zoroastrian influence here, but again, it's not so clear because you have that even in the classical traditions, you may have the cyclical time and the universal conflagrations. But it is appended at the end. I think this may have been a separate text, just 10 signs of the end of the world, which came attached. It's normal for these kinds of texts. What happens to Agathangel in Armenia? So as I said, it has nothing to say about Armenia. It was copied, so it was interesting enough, but not only, it became Armenianized. The first place we find it is the vision of Nerses, which I already mentioned. The earliest manuscript of the vision also has an important part on Jerusalem, but we don't have that version. The earliest version we have is the 11th century. So I'm fast forwarding to the 11th century and giving you a completely different map of what I showed. Anatolia was a very different place. The huge empires were not so huge anymore. We have a patchwork of Christian and Muslim states in the, let's say, historical territory of Greater Armenia. The Georgian Kingdom is the largest, which expands actually throughout the 12th century, will expand, and its main enemies would be the Seljuks, who had conquered Anatolia in the 11th century, yes, from 1020s on, and created there some Armenian enclaves here. We have other, this is the Seljukid Empire of Rum. It's also known as the Seljukid Empire of Iconium or Rum. We have Shaddadids of Ganza here, nominally vassals of Seljukids, but centrifugal Zengids of in the south. And here, very importantly, his Armenian kingdom of Cilicia, about which I will talk next. I go back to this a minute. So the vision of Saint Nerses takes information from Agathangel, but updates it to the 11th century. He coins, very importantly, a term known as the nation of the archers, which denotes the Seljuks. We have information from other Armenian sources who seem to imply that the population was terrified at their dexterity. The Seljuks were nomadic riders, excellent archers. while they are riding. So this kind of warfare, there is a study by a Byzantinist who thinks that by the 11th century, the Byzantine technology of fighting through archers was at its lowest. And this may be one of the explanations why the Seljuks were so successful, but of course there were other problems with the Byzantine Empire. This cannot be the only explanation, but nevertheless, Nerses' prophecy, when it was updated, coined the term nation of the archers. Will be very important in all sorts of other prophetic texts discussed in the 12th century, and of course, in the 13th century, who you think will be called the nation of the archers? The best archers at the time, the Mongols. And this prophecy will be updated yet again. Some of the elements, these prophecies also show the circular logic of this Vaticinia ex evento. Since the prophecy of Saint Sahak in the 5th century says that at the end of the world there are going to be comets, stars falling, storms, earthquakes, if there are such things, then we are going to prophesy that the end of the world is going to happen. So it never ends, you know. One thing is, if it doesn't happen, maybe we were wrong in calculating our dates. So in the 11th century, when you have the Seljuk incursions, there's a lot of trouble, a lot of violence, and also huge emigration from Armenia into Cappadocia first and then Cilicia. That's why we get the Cilician kingdom. But for example, a comet in 1025 is interpreted as a sign of the end of the world, and prophecies are pronounced again, and the natural disasters are combined with political disasters to create yet new schemes of prophesizing. The update of Agathangel in the Armenian milieu, so I move to the other two texts, the prophecies of Agathon and the vision of Saint Nerses, add very important elements. First of all, it is Armenianized. So along with Roman emperors, which are more now, and they're kind of cyclical. We have these messianic Roman emperors who are fighting some enemies, usually Ismailites, and creating peace, and then they die, and then the Ismailites are coming back, or the nation of the archers are coming back, and then they're fighting them again and again, ensuing a messianic reign. So there is four of those, and then the last two are rather towards the end of the world. But they're including also the Armenian history. Remember, we talked about the restorative aspect of the vision of Saint Sahak. This comes back into in both of the texts. Okay? Now, the prophecies look back to the first Armenian Christian king, Terdot and Saint Gregory. Remember their alliance with the Roman Empire, and create a new scheme where the restoration of the Armenian kingdom will happen with the help of a Western Roman emperor. In the 12th century, where is my map? Oh, but I think I have a better one. Yes. In the 12th century, you had this Cilician first barony, and then it becomes an independent kingdom, which was very much involved in the affairs of the Crusaders, supported the Crusaders, was allied with the Crusaders, intermarried with Western nobility, and in 1198, one of the rulers, one of the princes, was crowned as king by the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope. So obviously the image of the Western Roman Emperor who comes and restores, that existed before the coronation. But of course the dynasty capitalized on this, saying, okay, Levon, our king, is the... I don't have him here. Okay. No, sorry. Levon, who was crowned in 11, yes, I do have him. He's the last king. And in fact, at around 1202, an important Armenian theologian wrote a council about how you should behave at the end of the world, because we are at the end of the world. It is already in action. We have our last king, Levon. He has been crowned. The people who held the office of the Catholicos claimed to have an origin from the line of Saint Gregory the Illuminator. There was this so-called nepotism in this 11th century where the Catholical seat went from an uncle to a nephew. And the Byzantines complained about it, the Pope of course complained about it. But it went on for about four generations. And this was yet another element. They said, yes, we've got a Catholic was from the line of Saint Gregory, and we've got a king who is who was restored by the Western emperor. So we've got it all. And so I think in the end of the 12th century, there was a very heightened climate of eschatological speculations. And of course, from the Agathangel, the anti-Jewish polemic is reduced to a minimum. All this whole dialogue's very interesting psychological drama, the talks between Antichrist and the Jews are gone. They maintain the motive of the conversion of the Jews. Yes, I did not mention it. Why I thought the text was not so anti-Jewish is because the Jews are converting and they become martyrs of faith and are glorified for their behavior. This is remained, but they're no longer interested in these long histories. The last Roman emperor myth is maintained. Interestingly, that is also Arminianized. I didn't have it. Now, it's not just the Roman emperor who goes to put his crown on the Golgotha as a sign of the end of the world. In one text, he's accompanied by an Arminian king, the last Arminian king. So they both put their crowns because they are imagined to be the two superpowers in the Mediterranean, the Western Latin Empire and the Armenians, which of course is very anti-Byzantine polemic, because you did have an emperor. In the prophecies of Agathon, significantly also, the Armenian king will actually conquer Constantinople and take revenge for all the bad things that the Byzantines had done to his people and to his church. So all of this was done, we got the king, but the end of the world did not happen. What do you do? What do you do when the prophecy fails? Just rewrite. And you know, the history provided other motives for rewriting. The Mongols. The earliest when reports on the Mongols place them in an eschatological framework. This is, of course, also in the Western tradition. The Mongols were identified with the Gog and Magog first, and then later with the people from whom the Prester John or the King David of India will emerge, and there will be a crusade, a joint crusade from the East and the West to crush the Muslims. These legends were not popular in Armenian. There is one text which mentions it, but it's written in Latin. It's for a Western Latin public. In the Armenian tradition, they never became popular. And my feeling is because their frame of reference was different, was the vision of Saint Nerses, nation of the archers, and all the writers at whom I looked at the beginning of the 13th century constantly are referring to the vision of Nerses. William of Rubruk, when he passes through Armenia, he mentions, he says Agakron, which is obviously a reference to Agathon, the prophecies of Agathon, that was also updated to include the Mongol invasions. Here's, I just wanted to show the vast Mongol Empire, of which Armenia was on the westernmost fringes. It was subdued, of course. The Cilician kingdom had a vassal status. It was never attached directly, but the king had to make a trip to Karakorum to confirm the status at least twice, and they had to provide arms and forces, so they were subdued also to the Mongols. And I just wanted to read one colophon, but there are many, from 1236, which was the year when the actual conquest and sieges of the various cities in Armenia took place. And the Armenian manuscripts have this wonderful tradition for the historians, very strong tradition of writing colophons. So somebody copies a text and in the end writes, oh, my candle was not enough, my eyes were hurting. And by the way, who can tell the torments and calamities that befell us upon this ruthless nation of the archers, as the Holy Patriarch Nerses had told, having seen this with the eyes of his soul in the hour of his death. He said, the Armenians will be uprooted by the nation of the archers, and busy roads will become empty for the lack of humans. And this happened as he said. So while originally this was probably referring to, the prophecy of Nerses was about the Seljuks. Now it was referred to another Eurasian steppe nomadic people, and they probably found also similarities. I'm working on it now, how the image of the Mongols was very much influenced by the image of the Seljuks amongst the Armenian authors. And which Roman emperor was yet another question on which you could play and rewrite your prophecy. So it happens that with the Armenian movement of enlightenment, which actually started in India, in the Armenian community of Calcutta, I think it is not the Editio Princeps, but it is one of the earliest printed versions of the vision of Saint Nerses, which talks about the Western or the Roman Empire. It never says the Western, that is my interpretation, the Western. It says the Roman Empire. So it could be Byzantine. Probably in the 7th century it would be Byzantine. In the 12th century it was Roman. In the 18th century it was the Russian Empire, of course, because Moscow was the third Rome. So there was another, with the Enlightenment and the National Liberation Movement, there was another diffusion of interest in these apocalyptic texts from the Middle Ages with the political context of the pro-Russian orientation and liberation of Armenia. Sometimes, yes, in modern historiography, you still find this pro-Western interpretation of medieval texts, which in a way go back to that same general mindset. In conclusions, it seems to me that eschatological prophecies were a very important constant in the Armenian literary traditions, perhaps also in others. These are texts which have not been studied traditionally. Historiography is published, of course, poetry, you study that, philosophy, patristics, not eschatology. Also because it is very difficult to edit these texts. There is very permeous boundaries between texts. For example, I even have a question, where is the boundary between the vision of Saint Nerses and the prophecies of Agathon? You also have mixed texts. That is the worst. Then how to classify them? What should the title of the text be? Of course, it's very difficult to work, and also because of the updates. It is questionable whether one can provide a critical edition in a traditional sense of the word, or maybe, yeah, the ideal would be computer hypertext, but I don't know what happens when there is no more oil, there's apocalypse, we have no electricity, and we cannot access internet. So maybe we should print something anyway. So these eschatological prophecies were very important, copied profusely. They were used both when they were addressing situations of invasions, violence, crisis, but not only. As we saw also when you have a new king, so presumably you are at the apex of your political power or your situation, like the coronation of King Levon in the Cilician Kingdom of Armenia. And I see also coming from this tradition is the pro-Western messianism, which lasts until today within the Armenian general, let's say, a master narrative of who we, the Armenians, are. This pro-Western orientation, when you really have a very strong current of Eastern tradition going back to our cohabitation with Zoroastrian Iran and the Islamic powers around us or the ones who ruled us. Thank you very much for your attention.